History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we all have the chance to do something about it before it's too late, to ask a few questions, to listen for a while, and another step that may go without saying, take the perspective we gain and apply it to our lives. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want, of course, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Last weekend, we welcomed another World War II veteran into the ranks of the centenarians, and he's also one of the last original crew members, one of the last living plank owners from the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga in World War II. It was quite a scene in Santa Maria, California, where Bob Mettauer's 100th birthday was celebrated with sailors from the Pacific Fleet, ROTC cadets, and even the city's three-term mayor stopping by for a visit. The Friends of the National World War II Memorial Organization also spread Bob's story and photos far and wide in honor of that special occasion, and we're going to dedicate our program today to his unique story. Bob hit another century mark a few years ago when he eclipsed the 100,000-mile mark on his bicycle well into his 90s, thus the moniker Bicycle Bob that he answers to for many of his neighbors. But to put his century on the planet in perspective, it's best to go back to the beginning.
Well, I was born 5 houses inside the New York City limits in a place called Queens Village in the front bedroom. I have a twin sister. We had a German midwife, and she went first, got all the looks and all the brains, and I came in second.
Well, it's going to be tough. I mean, it's radio, so the looks don't matter, but the brains probably do. So we'll hope that this suffices. So growing up in the New York City area during the Great Depression, what were those days like? What are some of the things you remember about your childhood there?
Well, we didn't have any money. You know, it was pretty tough. My father somehow managed to buy a house, and we had a nice house in Queens Village. What I remember most is that when I was 16 years old, I was going to Jamaica High School, and I was a butcher boy. And in those days, the people call up on the phone and ask for some meat, and I would deliver the meat. And I would ride as much as 50 miles on my back on Saturday. I did it all every afternoon and all day Saturday. And for that, I got $12. And I had to give the $12 to my mother because we had to eat. That's the way it was.
Well, and I think of New York during the 20s and 30s, and I think the Bronx Bombers. Were you a baseball fan at all?
Yes, I was. Dodgers and Yankees. Dodgers were there until 1957 when they moved out to L.A., and so were the Giants.
So did you ever get to go to any of those games?
Well, I told you I have four daughters, and it was very tough going. It took me a long time to earn enough to pay for all of the things that my family was spending money faster than I could make it. It took me a long time till I could get a few quarters to rub together. And I was able to see one Dodger game, one Yankee game, and one football Giant game.
I'm sure those were memorable occasions, and I think a lot of people were identifying with you when you talked about the money being spent before you made it. So, you told me about being the butcher boy and delivering meat and all that, but before the war, before you got out of high school, did you have some ideas of what you wanted to do with your life or where you wanted to go, what kind of work you wanted to do?
No, I had none. It was tough to get a job. Nobody knew where the hell they were going to work. So it was tough to get a job.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't remember too much, other than the fact that December 7th was my father's birthday. But I do remember, that the Japanese bombed, Honolulu and Pearl Harbor and all that. I don't even think it occurred to me that I would be going into the service.
So when did that change? How did you end up in the Navy?
Well, that changed when I got drafted. I graduated after my 18th birthday, so I was drafted. and I had to go to the draft board. And at that time, the Navy was taking a terrible pasting in the Pacific. And my mother said, "Don't you dare go in the Navy," when I was going to the draft board. So I went to the draft board, and they said, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, "I want to go in the Army." He said, "No, not today. Today you're in the Navy." One of the biggest breaks of my whole life.
But you didn't think so at the time, or just your mother didn't think so at the time?
Well, I don't remember my mother's reaction, but I was certainly happy.
But you had a few hiccups along the way. I understand you had a little issue in boot camp.
Well, that's true. I was in boot camp, and I went to breakfast, and when I finished eating, I tried to get up and couldn't even get up. I had to put my hand in my stomach to support it, and I went to sick bay. It turned out I had appendicitis. They did surgery on me and put me in the hospital, of course, and I was in bed for 7 days during the war. And then after that, I had a month of light duty. Turned out the appendix surgery it was a good break for me, too. I wound up in the outgoing unit, and I got to know the first-class petty officer who was responsible for sending people out to different places, different schools and different ships and whatever. So I asked to be a radio man. He said, "No, that's congressional appointment." Went down, kept going, and finally I wound up with machinist shop school, and he said, "Well, you can go there." So I went to Wentworth Institute up in Boston, and we're up there for 4 months. And we marched from the Somerset Hotel to Wentworth Institute, back and forth every day. After the 4 months were over, they sat us down. They said, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to go into a submarine." Well, I had had surgeries before the appendix, so I was not a candidate for the submarines. You have to be perfect. So my second choice was an aircraft carrier, and that's how I wound up on the Ticonderoga, the aircraft carrier.
And you mentioned a couple things there. You said it was a break that they weren't drafting into the Army the day you went to the draft board, and it was a break that your appendicitis happened when it did. So flesh that out for me. I'm sure you've thought about this a few times. What do you think the other scenarios would have been? Why was that a good break for you?
I have no idea. I have no idea what would have happened otherwise. But I wound up on the Ticonderoga, and I was a plaque owner, and we had to go down to Newport News, Virginia. And there we were loading the ship with supplies and so forth. Then we went on a shakedown cruise. And a shakedown cruise, the purpose of that is to have the crew learn how to maneuver and operate the ship and do all of the functions that has to be done. And at the same time, they launched some planes off the carrier, so the crew got that experience. After that, we came back and loaded up again, and then we went through the Panama Canal, and we went to San Diego, and there we loaded up again. We were in San Diego, and while we were there, we were off out in the ocean a little ways and launching planes. And one of the planes had some problems, and it ditched into the ocean. So back on land, they sent a PBY out to take a look at what happened to the crew, and the commander said, "The weather's pretty rough out there, so don't land. Just come back and report what you see." When they went out there, they looked at the pilots were in a raft, and they saw that one of them was pretty badly injured. So they landed the plane and picked up the crew. When they got back to shore, the commander threw the pilot into the brig because he disobeyed orders. Well, Dixie Kiefer was the commander of the Ticonderoga. When he found out about that, he had a fit. And he went to that commander and said, "You know, you get that young man out of the brig in a hurry." And that's what happened.
Because he disobeyed orders, but he probably saved that pilot's life by doing it.
Could be. After that, we loaded up the plane. The ship was filled up with planes and on flight deck and all of that. And then we were on our way to Pearl Harbor.
And a lot of people listening probably haven't been on an aircraft carrier, certainly not an Essex-class carrier from World War II. Was it a little eye-opening to get aboard that ship and see how massive it was and how a giant an operation it really was?
Well, it was the largest aircraft carrier in the world at that time. We had a crew of over 3,000 people, and yes, you know, it was amazing. And of course, you know, you're young, so you just go ahead and do what you have to do.
And everybody has a little different role among that 3,000-man crew. So what was yours? What were your duties on the ship?
Well, I started out in the hydraulic gang, and that was steering gear, anchor windlass, and the elevators that moved the plane from the hangar deck to the flight deck. And I was in the number one elevator pump room, which was way forward, way down in the bilge. And my job there was, when they blew flight quarters, my job was to go down into the pump room and push a button, wait till the pressure got high, open up a valve, and then call up topside and tell them we're ready to go. And they were kind enough to call me in when I talked to them. They said, well, come on up. So I ran all the way from the bilge all the way up to the flight deck, and on the starboard side, the controls for the forward elevator were on the side of the flight deck. And we stood in gratings, look down through where you look through to the water, and that was how they operated with the buttons on the side of the elevator. The ship was loaded with planes, so they couldn't take off by themselves, so they had to be catapulted off. And when they catapulted the planes off, the wing would go right over our head as we were standing there.
I bet that's an experience nothing prepares you for.
No, that's right. It's quite exciting, really. And then they didn't just go, they didn't go right off. They dipped down and went down, and fortunately, there was 60 feet from the flight deck to the water, and they would probably go down to almost touch the water before they would have speed to go gone up.
So, you're aboard this ship, brand new ship. You just told us what your original role was. What about your first experience with what war's really like, your first taste of an enemy to deal with?
Well, on January 21st in 1945, we had just finished bombing Saigon. So we're down there, and we were coming out to go back to another assignment. We were coming out, we were between the Philippines and Formosa, when we took two kamikazes. And my role there was, they blew general quarters, of course, and my role was to go to the forward mess hall. That was my battle station. And when we got there, the place was full of water up to your knees. And so the first thing we had to do was to get the hatch closed where the water was coming down from the flight deck. And having done that, then we were okay. And we were communicating with battle control. So battle control told us to get out of there and move to another compartment, which we did, and was dry there. And by this time, with smoke all over the place, the smoke was being brought in by the blowers that would normally air the place, and we had to put on our gas mask, and the lights were out. So that's where we were. And then battle control told us they lost contact with the compartment behind where we originally were, and asked us to go in there and see what was going on. So I think I was one of the first ones that went in. And there was a gentleman, was a chow hall. So this gentleman was sitting there with a pen light flashlight in his hand, and it was on. So I thought he was okay, and I went and picked up one of the other people and took them down to sick bay because they were overcome. They had no gas mask on. I went back into the compartment like I was still sitting there with the flashlight. So I said, you better get out of here. And he was out cold. So I took him to sick bay.
And when you say take him to sick bay, you had to carry him?
Yes. And then on the second trip, I heard his voice. And it was Eddie Mazur, my best friend. We both worked in the machine shop, and we made weights. He was a body specimen, and we made weights, and I had set aside an apartment up forward above the flight the hangar deck. And when they blew general quarters, he was coming down the ladder when the first plane went through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck and made a piece of charcoal out of Eddie. It was terrible to see.
What, as I was listening to you describe this, I'm thinking all of this was terrible to see. And what prepares you for that? I mean, you're a 20-year-old kid. Had you guys even experienced anything like this before? Had you seen other ships get hit by kamikazes? Did you know that threat was there?
No, I never saw it, but we knew the threat because we had heard about it. You know, the experience of seeing Eddie, it was immediately, I knew there was nothing I could do. So I had to continue doing what I was doing to help the other people. And I still remember that. They'll never leave me.
And this was the guy that you'd spent a lot of time with, that you were probably with just the day before?
Yes, we were in the machine shop. We used to do things together. What he did was he made me cross my arms and cross my legs, and he'd pick me up and press me like I was a weight. That was the kind of a specimen he was. Wonderful young man.
So you come into that hold, that room, and you see him burnt to a crisp. You know he's already gone.
Yes, I knew it. And actually, he's listed as missing in action in this in my book. But I knew when I saw him, I knew he wasn't missing in action. He was doomed.
And what do you do in a situation like that? I'm sure there's a lot of emotions that come over you, but you're still expected to perform a job.
Exactly. That's just exactly what it was. And there I was helping people out of the other compartment. I just continue to do that.
And he continues to press on at age 100 in Santa Maria, California. More to come from Bob Mettauer and more about that best friend on the Ticonderoga. You can find photos and videos relating to Bob's story at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to celebrate 100 years of World War II Navy veteran Bob Mettauer. That's exactly what they did last weekend in Santa Maria on California's Central Coast. And there are some great photos at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks to Bob's friend Paula Hansel for sending those along. You'll see some current active duty sailors there with this World War II vet. And also Santa Maria Mayor Alice Patino, who made it a point to visit Bob on his big day. When we left off, we were listening to Bob describe the most harrowing day of his life almost 80 years ago aboard the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga, which was hit by not one, but two kamikazes on January 21st, 1945.
And then, of course, pretty soon, things calmed down, and they told us to go back to our original location, which was, in my case, was a machine shop. And on the way back there, myself and Thompson, who was walking with me, we found my friend Chuck Lodge. And he was without his gas mask. It had expired, and he was having real problems. So he and I, we used my gas mask back and forth so that he could get some fresh air until we got back to the machine shop. And when we got to the machine shop, it looked like nothing had happened at all. It was amazing.
And somewhere in there, there was another job that you ended up with, a pretty gruesome task to help some other sailors who had been injured. What about the bigger picture? I mean, as this is happening, you talk about the smoke everywhere. You're seeing some of the damage to shipmates, including your best friend who's killed. Are you wondering if your ship's going to make it? If you guys might even be sunk by this attack?
No, there was never any threat of that. We weren't worried about that at all.
Even though you got hit by two kamikazes?
Right. Well, they didn't damage the hull. You know, the ship itself was intact. All they did was jam the flight deck. So the ship was intact, so there was nothing to worry about.
And maybe before we get to your job of prying these rings off of guys whose hands are burned, maybe you can explain to us where those kamikazes hit on the ship and the extent of the damage. I know you've got some photos in this book that you shared with high school kids before, but for our listeners, paint that picture of where the planes hit and the damage that occurred.
Well, at that time, I had no idea. It wasn't until afterwards that I was able to go up topside and find out what happened. So I had no idea. But one of them went through the flight deck. It was forward of the island and on the starboard side. Went right through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar deck. And the other one hit the fire control turret on the island just above where Dixie Kiefer, our skipper, was, and injured him pretty badly, so he had to be taken off the ship.
In fact, in your book, which they produced right at the end of the war, there's a picture of the skipper of the ship, Dixie Kiefer, with a microphone in his hand in a hospital bed and people all around him. What was happening there?
Well, he was so badly injured, they were taking him off to put him on a hospital ship. And he was saying farewell to his crews and you know, keep up the good work and all of that. And there wasn't a dry eye on that ship when he left. He was such a fine man, great leader. And he became a world hero, a national hero.
Well, and you say there wasn't a dry eye on the ship. So I'm wondering, where were you while that was happening? And were you hearing this come over the PA system?
Yeah, I was down in the machine shop. I was down there when it happened. He came over the PA system, and everybody on the ship could hear him. And it was amazing because he was just a wonderful person, a wonderful leader.
Yeah, and I guess, and again, we're bouncing back and forth here a little bit, but I'm just thinking, if I'm a 20-year-old kid, and I've just been through all this, the damage to the ship, knowing how many guys were killed, including my best friend, and then I hear my skipper get on the PA knowing that he's been wounded and he's getting carried off. Did what he had to say help you process the situation you were in or motivate you for what you were going to be dealing with?
Well, to be honest, we were prepared for anything anyway. And the problem was when he was replaced, it just changed the entire attitude on the ship. Everything was different. The morale was different, and the person that took his place was not nearly the man that Dixie Kiefer was.
Well, let's talk some more about January 21st. So you told us some of what you experienced that day, and I'm sure it felt like a pretty long day. I think they hit you around noon, is that right?
Yeah, it was early in the day, yes.
So for the next several hours, it was probably nonstop action and busyness for you?
Well, it didn't, you know, really it didn't last that long, you know, because it happened so fast, and we were able to straighten everything out and get the fires out, and I would say probably an hour, that's all. And by that time, we were back in the machine shop.
And there's a book. You mentioned your daughter found a book where she works, the USS Ticonderoga book that has a lot of firsthand accounts from the men of the ship in there, and yours is in there. And there's something that you don't mention, but if I flip a few guys further and find Vern Rampa's account, he talks about a pretty gruesome assignment that the two of you had to carry out. What happened there?
Well, we received a phone call from sick bay about the men, some of the men that had their hands were severely burned, and the ring fingers, the ring was still on their finger, and it was killing them, the pain. So they called us up and asked if anything we could do. So my chief, Vern Rampa, said, yeah, let's send them up. So they sent us to the machine shop. And what I had a rag full of cold water and a long-nosed pair of pliers. And I had to dig deep into the wound, the burn, and lift that ring out so that Vern Rampa could grind it and cut it in half and we could take it off. And I think we did five or six of them.
And you had to do this because if you don't do that, they're going to lose those ring fingers. But what were those guys going through? I mean, are they screaming in pain? Are they gritting their teeth? And what did that feel like for you to be sticking those pliers in there?
Well, they were men, you know. They weren't crying. They knew we were trying to do the job, and that's what we did. And you know what? It doesn't take long before you become a man when you're in the service. And that's what happens. You know, we're no longer kids. We're men.
And I know this is a little extraneous, but I'm thinking there might be some wives out there who are saying, well, did they save those wedding rings or did they get rid of them?
I have no idea what happened to them.
Wasn't a priority at that point, huh?
No, not at all.
And you mentioned that during this whole time, you still haven't seen the damage that those kamikazes inflicted. When you did, when you got topside and you saw with your own eyes the aftermath, the damage, the devastation, what was that like for you?
Well, of course, you know, I was amazed, but by that time, it was all over. Now, there you go again, you know. You're men, you just have to go around and do what you have to do to take care of everything and make sure everything goes back to normal, and that's what we did.
Did you do something to recognize or honor or memorialize the guys who had been killed?
Well, the people were killed. There's nothing we could do for them. So they had a ceremony, and it was nothing we could do. We had nothing that we could do for the poor dead people. And who knew how long we were going to stay out at sea? Nobody knew that. So they had a program where they buried them at sea. And they covered them up, and they just... They were in a stretcher or something like that, and they tilted the stretcher, and the poor boys went overseas into the ocean, and it was not a very pleasant thing to see.
Well, and you've already told us your best friend was one of them, but is there also part of you that where it registers, hey, that could be me that they're dropping into the water?
Well, of course, it's, you know, that could have happened to anybody. Fortunately, I was down below decks, and I didn't have any problems at all, personally. Of course, I told you the story about what we had to do.
So that's January 21st of 45, and there's still another 7 months of the war in front of you. You mentioned that kind of the atmosphere of the ship changed after the change in command. But what about your role on the ship? Did that change? Did your duties stay the same, or did you move into something else?
Well, what happened there was when we got back to, we had to be repaired, and we went back out, and we were off the coast of Japan bombing Tokyo when the atom bombs were dropped. And right after that, we toured the coast of Japan before the actual surrender. And when the Japanese surrendered, we docked in Yokohama, and I had read the book Unbroken, and in Unbroken it said that the prisoners of war that had been in the Japanese prison camps and treated like terribly, they were taking the train to Yokohama, and I actually was allowed to go in the docks of Yokohama. And while we were there, we picked up 500 who I assume were prisoners of war to take them back to the States.
And they must not have looked very good.
Well, actually, they were in the hangar deck, and I really never even saw them.
And you're talking about your planes bombing Japan in the days leading up to the surrender, and even really up to and past the surrender, probably. They're still flying sorties and bombing Japan. And that makes me wonder, you had all these pilots on your ship this whole time you're there. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of planes that are taken off. How did you guys, the ship's crew, get along with those Navy flyers?
We never saw them. Now, they were in a different area. They were in a different area for the officers and the pilots, and when I was down below decks, I never saw them. Mm-hmm. But I did. I did enjoy watching. I used to go up on the island and watch the planes come in, and I saw many barrier crashes and all kinds of crazy things. And I think I told you about watching the planes take off with the planes going over my head, and that gave me the desire to try to fly an airplane.
So what'd you do with that desire?
First of all, I had my four daughters through college. And then I started to have a couple of nickels together, and I worked for the telephone company, and they started a telephone company employees flying club. And I was involved with that, and we flew out of Long Island MacArthur, and I learned how to fly a four-seat Cessna Skyhawk, which was, the identity was November 15,000. And we used to call, when we called the tower, we say that's November 15,000, and they would shorten it to 000, so it didn't take so long on the, over the radio.
But you didn't have to take off and land from a carrier anyway.
No. As I say, I had my four girls through college before I could do this.
Well, and for your four girls to exist, you had to make it through the war, which obviously you did. And I'm just thinking, if you get kamikazed in January of 45, and I know it's two or three more months that they're repairing the ship before you guys go back out, but when you did go back out, was there that fear or concern or awareness that what happened before could happen again?
No, we knew that Japan was licked, and we did go out, and as I said before, we bombed Tokyo 11 days in a row before they dropped the atom bombs. But they lost all their experienced pilots, and the way they had a few left, and what they did was this kamikaze business, they had a good pilot. And they had a bunch of kids that could take the plane up and follow their leader. And when he got them to the task force, he told them that they knew that they had to go and fly right into one of the vessels in the task force. By that time, there was no more air battles or anything like that. They were beat.
But just because the enemy wasn't quite as potent anymore doesn't mean he was out of the woods. How did that 20-year-old sailor handle Halsey's typhoon? And we'll circle back to his best friend aboard that aircraft carrier and a long overdue connection with his family. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we honor 100-year-old Bob Mettauer of Santa Maria, California, who just reached that century mark last weekend. We first met Bob about 6 years ago, so there have been a few updates to his story since, like when the local TV news on California's Central Coast covered his reaching 100,000 miles on his bicycle. And another more sentimental twist we'll revisit in a moment. For more than 79 years, Bob has carried the memories of more than 100 of his shipmates who were killed in a kamikaze attack on the USS Ticonderoga.
So, as far as you experienced it firsthand, that January 21st of 45 was the only time you really had a scare?
Exactly. No problems after that.
But the enemy is one thing, and the weather's something else. And I understand your ship had to navigate through not just the famous typhoon, Halsey's typhoon in December of 44, but maybe even another typhoon as well. Do you remember some of those weather conditions you faced?
Oh, I do. It was It was actually amazing. The waves, I went up topside. The island had a hatchway that you could go out onto the flight deck. And I actually went up there and stood on the flight deck and saw these, what I call liquid mountains. They were so strong and so big that on several of the aircraft carriers that were in the task force, it actually bent the corners of the flight deck, just bent them right up, and they were supported by a 6-foot I-beam. But that never didn't happen to the Ticonderoga. We were very fortunate.
That's got to be a little scary, though, to look up, you say, a liquid mountain, and that liquid mountain's about to crash over the deck of the ship.
Well, of course, but I would, that's why I went up to see it, and it was pretty exciting. I don't know, whether when they have hurricanes in the East Coast, whether waves were that big, but they sure were big there.
And I'm sure that wherever you were on that ship, you were feeling it a little bit.
Oh, yes. But actually, I always say it was like riding in a Cadillac. Because destroyers of the waters breaking over the ship and all of that kind of stuff, and we're kind of just going through all of it because we're so big.
What about the guys that you served with? I mean, you've mentioned a couple names there, but just generally speaking, how did you all get along, and what did you come to appreciate about the kind of people they were?
For instance, there was one guy that didn't change his clothes. He was dirty, somebody threw him in the shower. But for the most part, everybody got along well. But the biggest problem, we went as long as 8 months without seeing land. And here you are in this vehicle, the ship, you can only go so far. And the nights, the days were okay because you had something to do. But the evenings were terrible, and most of the guys took their money out and gambled. But I was fortunate enough to be next to my friend Vern Rampa, and he invited me into the machine shop. And I spent my evenings in the machine shop, and I was learning how to use the lathes and the milling machines and all that. And one day the division officer came over to me and said, "How would you like to work in the machine shop?" And boy, did I jump at that. Because my job in the elevator pump room was boring. All we did was scrape gratings and clean bilges and stuff like that. So the machine shop was a very, very good upgrade.
Your planes are bombing Tokyo right on up to Japan's surrender. When the news came that Japan had surrendered, and I've seen in your diary where you wrote it down at the time, but what was it like on that giant aircraft carrier when that news came to 3,000 men?
Well, it's really it's really funny. There was a big cheer, and then it lasts about 20 seconds, and you realize you weren't going anywhere. You were still going to be there. So it was a big cheer, and then that was it. You knew you were going to be on that ship for many more months. So that was about the best of it.
And you would be on that ship for many more months, and you guys did several trips bringing troops back from the Pacific?
Well, what happened is when we got in, they took all of the planes off, and they converted the hangar deck into a bedroom, and they put these pipe racks all the way from the top to the bottom, floor to the ceiling, and they had about 10 bunks high, and we carried about 3,000 sailors or prisoners of war or whatever back to the States. They were allowed 2 meals a day. Because the kitchen wasn't built to feed so many people, so they were allowed 2 meals a day. And we went out 3 times. And after the third time, I was preserving the machinery in the machine shop, and I was finally discharged.
And what did that feel like, to come back to America, to see your mom and dad and twin sister again? Were there ever days out at sea where you wondered if that would ever happen?
Of course, we always had that in mind, but when we got back, I told them that I had purchased a car, and they would give us a penny and a half for a mile for train tickets, and they didn't charge us anything. So we wound up with about $150 traveling across country, and I stopped in Chicago and bought myself a Easter outfit, a suit.
And was it different? Was life in America different after that? I mean, war had been the reality for more than 4 years, and now all of a sudden it's over. Did you notice a difference maybe just in your own outlook?
You know, now you're in a position where you have to take care of yourself again. I was trying to get a job. I was setting pins in a bowling alley. I was caddying $5 for doubles. That's a bag on each shoulder and 18 holes for $5. Finally, my wife and I were married now, too, by the way, and neither one of us had a job. I went after a job in a telephone company. Well, what happened, it was interesting there because we had to go to Brooklyn, and they had this huge room with these tables all across the room, rows of them. They had dividers between where each person sat. They lined us all up and put us in these chairs. And there was somebody up in front of the room. He said, now, there's a device there on your table, and we'd like you to take it apart. So I thought, well, they're going to want me to put it together. And they timed you. I took it apart and laid everything orderly. And they said, okay, now put it together. And they were timing us. So put it together. And I put it together faster than I took it apart. That made me an installer. It was like going in the Army as a sergeant, and I was going to make $42 a week, and the other guys that didn't get installers, they became linemen, climbing poles, and they made $33 a week. So that little scheme cost gave me $9 more a week.
A couple things come to mind. One, I mean, it's been a long time. Have you ever gone to any ship's reunions for the Ticonderoga?
Yes, we did. My wife received a phone call. And it was from a man that was helping to try to organize a group, for the veterans group. He said to my wife, is it possible your husband was in the Navy during World War II? And she said, yes. Is it possible that he served aboard the USS Ticonderoga? She said, yes. And he said to her, wonderful. He said, my name is Harold Crane, but he says, I changed my name. It used to be Krinowitz. And she says, oh, Stinky Krinowitz. And that's how we got involved with the Veterans Association, and we're all over the place, and they still do it today. But I don't go any longer because there's nobody I know anymore. They're all gone.
Well, and one of the reasons I asked about the reunions, I was wondering if you ever encountered any of those guys whose fingers you saved by getting their rings off.
I don't think I ever did.
Have you ever wondered what happened to them and how their lives turned out?
No, I knew they were okay. You know, you should have seen the expression on their face when those rings came off.
Relief or pain?
Relief and pain.
Well, and the other thing that I have to ask you about, and I understand maybe it's not something that's easy to talk about, but your friend Eddie Mazur, I'm sure that experience as a 20-year-old is not something that anything could prepare you for. But in all the years since, have you ever thought, what would Eddie have done with his life? What kind of a human being, what kind of an American would he have been?
Well, I knew what kind of American he was and what kind of a human he was. But I'm sure he was pretty clever. I'm sure he would have made a fine living for himself.
And pretty strong, it sounds like, too.
Yes, he was.
I'm guessing he's the only one who's ever lifted you up over his shoulders like a barbell?
As far as I know, but I can tell you this, that I used to do it with my daughters.
Uh-huh.
I have 4 daughters.
I'm sure Eddie would have been proud of that. And, you know, he's one of the more than 406,000 Americans who lost their lives in World War II. That's so long ago and so far away, and for most of the people listening, before they were even born. So what do we need to know about those men? How should they be remembered today?
Well, I think everybody remembers them the same way. They were all heroes. They were all heroes. And even today, I wear my World War II cap, and I have people come over to me and say thank you for your service. Actually, it's usually the senior citizens or the older people. The younger people, they don't. The World War II is not a part of their lives.
Well, maybe if they're listening right now, it will be, and I'll jump on board and say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling your story to all of us today. Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you think we ought to know?
I told you before that I learned how to, when I saw the airplanes catapulted off, I got the desire to fly. And it got to the point where I was able to pay all the bills with my family was, you know, they, I told you before, they were making money, spending money fast I could make it. And at that time, they started a telephone employees flying club. I worked for a telephone company, and I was able to learn how to fly an airplane, which I was pretty proud of. I always say the finest time of my life was when I was married and all these little baby girls started showing up. No doubt in my mind that was the finest time of my life.
Before we sign off today, we're going to circle back to the most trying time of his life and that kamikaze attack. When we first met Bob, he had never had any contact with the family of his best friend Eddie Mazur, who of course he remembered so fondly. But because Mazur's nephew, Fred, had set up a website in honor of his family's Gold Star hero, we were able to make that connection. And Fred Mazur's voice is one Bob has come to know quite well.
Well, my father came from a very large family. He was he was one of 12 children. He was right in the middle of the 12. Eddie was the youngest. Christmas and Easter and all the holidays, we would go over to grandmother's, and all the siblings would be over there, and then all their children, which were my cousins, were there. So we had a very large gathering every holiday. So Eddie came up in conversation every time, just stories upon stories about how intelligent he was, how talented he was, how athletic he was. At that time, he had set track and field records at New Kensington High School in New Kensington, Pennsylvania. And in fact, when I was a young boy, somebody in the family had home movies, and I'm guessing it was probably 8mm format. I don't think that's what it was. And there were movies of him going up and down the steps at my grandmother's on his hands. And he was so athletic. He could walk up and down steps faster on his hands than most people could go up and down on their feet. And that was just one of many things he could do. He was very acrobatic. He was very strong. Bob told me a story once that he would use Bob Metzauer as a weight. He would pick him up, like Bob would cross his arms on his chest, cross his legs, and then Eddie would bench press Bob. That's how strong Ed was.
As a matter of fact, I used to do that with my daughters.
Because he taught you how to do it?
Yeah. Well, I've seen a broad jump 18 inches on his hands.
Yeah, he was amazing. Anyhow, the word was, and I think Bob told us this too earlier, was that Ed was up on the deck of the Ticonderoga doing his exercises and doing his acrobatics up on the deck when the Japanese suicide planes came in. And Ed was on his way down to his station in the machine shop, and he didn't make it. Bob, you would know better what that was, a ladder that went down to the floor down below, and I guess he was in that tube whenever the plane hit.
And what they were doing, we made weights. We made weights in a machine shop at night. And they had this room up, you know, some kind of a compartment set aside for them to lift the weights and do their exercises. And that's where he was. And when he came down the ladder, it was an enclosed ladder, you know, had sides to it. And that's where he was when the plane exploded on the hangar deck.
So he was just enveloped and engulfed in flames. And when you saw him, he was very badly burned, but still able to communicate.
You know, later on, I was taking people from a compartment that were all overcome from, they didn't have the gas mask on. I was taking people into the sick bay. And when I took the second person in, I heard Eddie's voice, and I saw him, and he was in one of the bunks. You know, they had these nice, comfortable places for the ill to be, and he was right there. You know, the second one, and I looked at him, and I couldn't do anything. There wasn't anything I could do. You know, and I could see that he wasn't going to last. You know. And so I just went back out and got another guy to take back in there, you know, and that's how I remember it.
You know, and I was trying to remember, Bob, the first time we talked and you told me that story. You weren't looking for attention for it, but you made it very clear that you had to carry some of those guys out of there who had been overcome by the fumes and had passed out.
Right.
Were you ever decorated for that?
No.
Because that's the kind of thing that a lot of guys were decorated for.
Well, maybe, you know, but I don't think anybody ever knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
except the people maybe that I carried in there.
I'm sure they haven't forgotten. Some of them may be wondering how in the world they got out of there. They may not even know that you carried them.
Right.
I know we're bouncing around here, but let me come back to Fred. So, Fred, you grow up with this awareness of your uncle, the war hero, who made the ultimate sacrifice, made your family a Gold Star family. What significance did that hold in your life, and what was it that prompted you to create a tribute to him online eventually?
Well, Eddie died for the freedoms that we all enjoy, and that touched me. I'm sorry, I'm a little emotional here. Eddie was a man that...
So, Bob, because Fred had put that online tribute to his uncle, that's how the two of you got connected. It had been there for years, but you weren't aware of it. And then you finally had a chance to talk to a member of Eddie's family. What was that like for you all those years later to connect with Fred and to go back and forth with him?
Well, it was interesting, you know. Years had passed, and Eddie had kind of disappeared in my life, and now here all of a sudden, there he is again, you know. So it's kind of interesting.
Bob, I have to tell you this. When we went through all those artifacts that we donated to soldiers and sailors, you composed a letter and sent it to my grandmother, and that's in the artifacts that are going to be down there. You expressed your sympathy for the loss of your friend and her son.
Right. I remember that.
Well, that letter is alive, and it will be in the memorial. I didn't know if you knew that.
Yeah, that's something.
I want to thank Bob for service to his country, and I want to thank Bob for being my uncle's best friend, because my uncle, from all accounts, was one of the best people you'd ever want to meet. I'm sure he held Bob dear as a friend. I thank you, Bob. Your sacrifice to this country also is much appreciated by all. God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. You know, Eddie was a special person. I felt fortunate that I was able to know him, and I just wish that things had changed, you know. What happened didn't happen, you know, but there's nothing he can do about that.
No, there isn't, but we all know more about Eddie Mazur's story and his sacrifice because Bob was willing to share his story, a story that has now taken him past the century mark. So if you know Bob Mettauer, wish him a belated happy 100th birthday. And join us again next time on Hometown Heroes, when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.